Woo. Woo. That song of that, well, every Paul Wilbur song is awesome, but the Going Up to the Mountain song, that's like the whole Isaiah chapter 2. We're going to talk about half of it tonight, probably. But, you know, you got to put Isaiah into a really important context because, first of all, his Hebrew name is Yeshayahu, which means salvation comes from God. So that's pretty neat. So even in his name, there's prophecy. Now, he's writing 700 and some years before Jesus is even born. It's pretty amazing. And he had a pretty long period of time where he prophesied, like, I don't remember how many years it was, but it was like over four different kings. So it was a long period of time. So even his name is prophetic. And as you go through Isaiah, we're not going to go through all of Isaiah. He has 66 chapters. You know, he has his own scroll. That's how you know you've made it. Yeah, that's right. So interestingly, you know you've made it as a major prophet when you have your own scroll. This is like, you know, in Luke 4, they handed Yeshua the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and he read from it. So that's pretty neat. 66 chapters. You know, and this, I like to joke, you know, sometimes he meets other prophets in heaven and says, you had three chapters? I had 66 chapters. No. He doesn't say that because Paul says there's no boasting. Right? That's a joke. You're supposed to laugh. That's right. Exactly. But you go through Isaiah, there's a lot of stuff about Gentiles coming. There's a lot of stuff about the kingdom being for everyone. There's a lot of stuff about people who don't seek me are going to find me. People who don't know me are going to know me. And there's a description, of course, everybody knows 52 and 53. There's a description of the suffering Messiah. There's a description of what it looks like when somebody's put on this Roman instrument of execution that he's so marred beyond human appearance, he's not even recognizable. You know, Isaiah's writing this 700 years before it happens, which is pretty neat. And there's so much stuff there about how God brings salvation. And there's so much stuff in there about what's called the bridal paradigm. You know, one of his verses is, I who am your maker have become your husband. There's so much stuff in it that sometimes a lot of commentators have called it the gospel according to Isaiah, because everything is in there that's the gospel of salvation in this Old Testament book from 700 and some years before Messiah is even born. So it's pretty cool. But we're just going to do a little bit of that. Maybe we'll do some more of that later, but we're going to go to chapter 2. Oh, I always forget to turn this on. We're going to go to chapter 2. Oops. Now, chapter 2 starts a lot like chapter 1. You can read chapter 1 for your homework. But he says, the word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it came to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. Oops, it came twice. See how important it was? It came twice. So he's talking about, and then it says, all the nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways. We just sang that in the song. So, interestingly, we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So something's being set up that's a mountain that towers above every other mountain. You know, we've heard about mountains of Israel. We know about Mount Zion. We know about Mount Moriah. And we know the temple was on top of Mount Moriah. And we know that that was the holy place where Isaac was almost sacrificed. But this is going to be a mountain that's higher than all the other mountains. He's talking about the Messianic kingdom. He's talking about the kingdom of the Messiah. And it says he has a vision about Judah and Jerusalem. He has a word that he believes. You know, the actual wording is kind of interesting. The word that Isaiah saw. You know, in chapter 1 it says Isaiah had a vision. In chapter 2 it says there was a word that he saw. It's kind of neat. So he got such a powerful word from God that he could actually see it happening. And it's about what's going to happen in Judah and Jerusalem. So it's just as if he had seen it with his own eyes. He can confidently say what's going to happen. You know, like the prophets all spoke under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, right? They didn't decide to be a prophet, and they didn't decide to go down to the corner and just say some prophecy that they thought might be interesting. The false prophets did that, because people always like the false prophets better than the true prophets, right? And that's true even today. People want to hear about, you know, God wanting you to be rich. They don't want to hear about take up your cross and follow me. That's a lot harder to deal with. So people liked false prophets who told them happy things. You know, Isaiah at the beginning of his book, the first chapter is all about judgment that's going to come. Because you guys have idols and you guys are breaking the covenant. You know, people don't like to hear that kind of thing. Jeremiah said, everything here is going to be destroyed. And the people said, no, there's no way. The false prophets all had bigger congregations than Jeremiah did. Because everybody liked to hear the false prophets talk. Because the false prophets said, don't worry, everything's cool. We got the temple here. We got the priests over here. We got all the stuff over here. Isaiah's just a party pooper. Or Jeremiah's just a party pooper. Don't listen to him. So Isaiah sees this, and he says it's in the latter days. He doesn't say it's like right now. He doesn't say it's going to start next week. He says it's going to be in the latter days. Now, interestingly, the writer to the Hebrews tells us that when Jesus came, that started the last days. We kind of know that, right? We know now that we're in the last of the last days. But even those guys in the first century thought the Lord was going to come back any time. Even Paul talks about, oh, you know, it's coming pretty soon. John says, come pretty soon. Peter says, come pretty soon. And we're saying he's coming pretty soon, but now we know he's coming pretty soon because 2,000 years have gone by. But he says this is going to happen in the latter days. And he's talking about Messiah setting up his kingdom. And after this whole long wait that came before Isaiah and a whole long wait that comes between Isaiah and Messiah, it's finally going to happen. They waited a long, long time for this. A long, long time. From Genesis 3:15 till the time Jesus is born is a long time. All the laws, all the prophets, all those things, the whole Old Testament is waiting for Messiah's first coming. Now here we are waiting for Messiah's second coming, which I hope is tonight, but it's going to come soon. Yeah. So after this long wait, this is going to be the final dispensation. This is the latter days. There's a mountain that's going to be set up that's even higher than the Temple Mountain. You know, they sang, because, you know, the Psalms weren't recited like we recite them. They were sung. So as they would go up the steps to go to the temple, they would sing the Psalms of Ascent, because you were going up a pretty, you know, good-sized hill. And you would recite, you would sing the Psalms that David wrote, 121 through 134, because they were all about how awesome Jerusalem is, and pray for Jerusalem, and isn't it great to be in the city, and isn't it great to be, this is where the tribes come to praise. So as you're going up the mountain, you're praising as you go that you're in the holy place. This is where God has put his name. He hadn't put his name anywhere else. You know, Jesus told the woman at the well much later, you know, now we worship in Jerusalem, but someday, you know, there's going to be worshipers in spirit and truth, and they're going to be worshiping everywhere. It doesn't have to be in Jerusalem. But this is where he put his name. And he's pointing to the final dispensation, waiting for the first coming. And it's going to be a mountain that's going to be set up as the highest imaginable place. They thought the temple was the unimaginable place, right? And it really was at this time. Once in a while, they still saw the Shekinah glory. But now this kingdom is going to be set up as the highest mountain. So it's going to be exalted above everything else. So this is the Messianic kingdom. Messiah is going to be exalted above everything else. And it's kind of like we know that there was Mount Zion, and then we know that there's the heavenly Jerusalem, right? At the near the end of the book of Hebrews, it says, you know, we're now, you know, at first we were at Mount Sinai going, wow, isn't this awesome? And now we're going to be at an even more amazing mountain that's going to be the final kingdom, the kingdom of the Messiah. And we're going to be in a heavenly Jerusalem, not the earthly Jerusalem, which is pretty neat. So, you know, Jesus talked about when there's a city on a hill that can't be hidden. You know, the Messianic kingdom can't be hidden. You know, Jesus never said, you know, we're going to keep everything quiet and everything secret. But let me tell you, don't tell too many people this, but I'm really the Messiah, and I want you guys to go out and spread the word. But just be careful. Don't talk about it when you're grocery shopping, and don't talk about it at work. And don't talk about it with your neighbors. We're going to keep it secret. No, he says it's a city on a hill, can't be hidden. You know, he says, what I'm going to tell you now, you've got to shout from the rooftops. Nowhere in any scripture in that whole Bible does it say, well, your faith is a very private matter. Don't tell anybody. Right? How can it be a private matter? You know, after you read the Great Commission, how can you say, oh, I better not say anything because it's my private matter? So it's a city on a hill, can't be hidden. And it's openly proclaimed. This kingdom is openly proclaimed. And everything is done publicly. You know, Jesus told those guys, I've always spoken openly. I never taught anything in secret. Why don't you ask, if you're looking for witnesses and you want to know what I said, why don't you ask the people that heard me? Because plenty of people heard me teaching. Why don't you ask them what I said? Why are you asking me? You bunch of bozos. That's only in the original languages. The bunch of bozos. But if you don't understand the original Greek, you don't pick that up. Yeah. If you don't know the original Greek, you miss that part. So he says, I didn't do anything privately. Everything was spoken openly. The apostles spoke openly. When they started carrying out the Great Commission, they didn't do their stuff in secret. Sure, sometimes they had to worship in secret. And many of them, well, almost all of them were killed. And hundreds and thousands of people were killed during the persecutions that came through the first couple centuries. But everything was done in the open. In fact, the Messianic kingdom, which begins with the sacrifice of the cross, is done publicly. The cross was a public execution. The Romans never killed people in private unless they were Roman citizens. Paul got taken someplace and beheaded because he was a Roman citizen, so they were not allowed to be crucified. But when they crucified somebody, as Norm wrote on here, they put the charge against them on top of the cross. And they always did it in a public place. You know, when you read those accounts of Good Friday, there's like people walking by, milling around. There's people watching him carry the cross. There's, you know, it's not like a secret thing. Everybody sees it happen. Plus, it's Passover. It's a pilgrimage feast. So there's thousands more people in Jerusalem than normally watching this. The cross is put on a hill. It's by a public road. People walking by and looking at it. The Romans, the high priests and the Romans could have taken them and just killed them out in the wilderness. Or they could have killed them in the basement of the jail. Or they could have taken them out somewhere where nobody was and killed them. But he's killed in a public place because the cross is the standard that's lifted up for everyone. And this is also in Isaiah. You know, it's a banner that's raised up above everyone that everyone goes to. You know, the people had banners. I think we did a thing about banners once. The people had banners, and everybody went to their banner, but this is the ultimate banner. A public execution. You know, in Colossians 2, Paul writes that Jesus made a spectacle of Satan on the cross. Remember reading that? Well, if you'd have been there that day, not really understanding what was going on, it would look to you like, man, this poor guy on this cross, he's suffering, he's dying, he's bleeding, he's, you know, going to die any minute. He looks like the one who's the public spectacle. Right? Because they didn't understand what was going on. Had you been standing there, had we been standing there that day, we wouldn't have understood what was going on. Because it looked like some poor guy who did something bad was being executed. And the Romans wrote on top of the cross what the crime was. In public. So if you rose up and killed a couple of Roman soldiers, and then they grabbed you, put you on a cross, at the top of the cross they'd write, he killed two Roman soldiers. So when people were walking down the road and they'd look at the cross and it said, he killed two Roman soldiers, and they saw you bleeding, suffering, suffocating, they'd say, ooh, I better not do that. It was to get people to understand that if you broke their law, there was going to be serious consequences. And God uses even that in salvation history, right? We have sin with serious consequences, but every single charge is put on the cross. If they would have put the true charges against him the way they did it for he killed two Roman soldiers, there would be a list of charges that go from Adam and Eve eating the apple to whatever the last sin to be committed is going to be, whenever that's going to be, would all be on that cross. Right? So it's a public spectacle of Satan. Here's the crime, and here's the guy who's paying the price. Here's the guy who's paying the penalty for it. So it's set up publicly, and it's going to lead to the highest mountain that there is. That's a standard for the people. You know, and another place in Isaiah, I love Isaiah. You know, he says, indeed, this is 49:6, indeed, he says, it is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also give you as a light to the Gentiles, that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. The ends of the earth. Do you think all those guys in the temple in Jerusalem would have ever imagined that Gentiles were going to be included in this? Even Peter couldn't figure this out for a long time. Remember? Peter's like, I don't know. I don't know. If he's eating with Gentiles and he sees the Jews come, he goes, oh, I better not sit with these Gentiles or I'm going to get in trouble. You know, this is how they were raised. Isaiah himself couldn't have figured this out, because if you look at this, the way it's written, this is Messiah speaking through Isaiah. Because that's what the prophets were. When you read a lot of the Psalms, it's David writing them, but it's God speaking through David, And sometimes when you read the passage, it's actually a passage about Jesus, not about David. It's pretty complex, but it's pretty awesome. And Isaiah's got a lot of this. And so he says, nations are going to flow to it. Now remember, when the Bible talks about nations, what's it talking about? Gentiles. The nations. You know, the Jews call them the goyim, the nations. You know, goy is kind of a derogatory word, you know. So when they want to make fun of a Gentile, they go, oh, he's a goy. But it is actually the Hebrew word for Gentile. But it's also derogatory in their speech. So the Gentiles, you know, were the unclean, non-covenant people. They're the goyim. I didn't even want to be with them. You know, if still to this day, if a Jewish man marries a Gentile woman, they'll say his bride is from the nations. They'll say that to this day. Because there's always a distinction. So the nations are going to be flowing to this mountain. Now, normally, water flows down a mountain, right? Water doesn't usually flow up a mountain unless you got some kind of pump. But everything flows downward. But these nations are going to go up the mountain. And since this is the kingdom of Messiah, and now the Gentiles are going up the same mountain, there's the spiritual children of Abraham and the real children of Abraham going up the mountain. So here we are. We're not blood children of Abraham, right? Probably not. I got 3% DNA, but we can't even count that. But we're all Gentiles here. But we're spiritual children of Abraham. Because through Abraham comes Messiah, and through Messiah we have salvation. So therefore, Abraham's our spiritual father in some way, even though we don't have his DNA. So we have the children of Abraham who were separate before, covenant, non-covenant, clean, unclean, all going up the mountain together. This is the whole concept of the one new man in Ephesians 2. The partition is broken down, and it says in this verse, in these verses, that the partition's broken down in his flesh. He breaks down the division and makes one new man. You know, so Pastor Dan and I were talking about this morning. You know, there can't be a Gentile church and a Jewish church. You can't say, well, we're Jewish believers and we have our church over here, and the Gentile believers have their church over here. We're supposed to be one new man. We're all supposed to be flowing up the mountain. All the nations are going to go, circumcised and uncircumcised. And it doesn't sound like these people are being forced to go up. Right? They're just going up. It's time to go up to the mountain. Because Jesus gathers everyone into the kingdom. It's not forced. Yeah, sounds like they can't wait to get there. Exactly. And as I was reading through this again the other night, I was thinking that, you know, as you go with a whole bunch of people towards something, you all are happy, encourage each other, say, hey, we're going up to the mountain. Hey, and the passage says, oh, let's go up to the mountain. It doesn't say, oh, I guess we better go up there. Or nobody's saying, eh, I don't feel like going up there. Or you guys go, I'll catch you later. There's like this big excitement of let's go up to the mountain. So they're encouraging each other to go. You know, the early few decades of the church, can you imagine how those people had to encourage each other? Romans were killing them. Other people were killing them. They're meeting, having, you know, prayer meetings and services and catacombs and people's houses. But they encouraged each other. Paul says encourage each other with this news. You know, Paul never writes, oh man, things are looking pretty bad, so everybody just go home and lay down and watch TV. He says you have to encourage each other with these words, right? So their people are going up, and they're flowing like a stream. It's pretty neat. And this has been going on since Good Friday, Easter morning. People have been flowing to the mountain. And it says they go up the mountain. You know, you notice the Bible always talks about going up to Jerusalem. Jerusalem's a high place. Everything else is lower than Jerusalem. You go up to Jerusalem. You make Aliyah, which is the term, if a Jewish person moves from here to Israel, says, I'm going to live in Israel from now on, that's called making Aliyah. But it actually means going up. If you're in a synagogue, you have this bima up on a platform. It's always higher than the people, right? Like many churches have it. It's always higher than the people. And if the rabbi or the teacher says, Joe, would you like to come up here and do this reading? It's called Aliyah, because he goes up to the bima, up to the pulpit. So it's always going upward, because the word is always above the level of the people. So it's a going up the mountain like you went up to Jerusalem. So how do these people get into this stream? You know, God always respects our free will, right? He doesn't force anybody to come up the mountain, right? Like Hank Hanegraaff likes to say, he doesn't drag anybody kicking and screaming into heaven. If you don't want to go, he says, okay, you don't have to go. He's never going to force you to be saved. Never going to force you. It's a free will decision. You have the free will when you leave here tonight to do whatever you feel like doing, right? And he always keeps that in mind. So this flow is formed by evangelization, by encouragement. It's people who realize that now they're saved. And so they're so excited that they willingly go up the mountain. You know, this is what the ancient creeds, like the Nicene Creed, calls this the communion of saints. Because the saints are always flowing together up the mountain. The people that are saved. So it's pretty neat. So it's not forced on anybody. And the church is built on top of this big mountain. Just like I talked about the rock in those songs. And we did a bunch of teachings about the rock. It's a rock of our salvation. It's built on the rock, which is Christ. And it's set up as the highest mountain. It's exalted above all the other mountains. It's above the idolatry and the mess of the world. Right? We're in the world, not of the world. You know, at the Transfiguration, remember Peter says, oh, Lord, it's really great to be here. Let's just make some tents and we'll stay here. Jesus says, nope, we got to go back down there now. Right? You come to church on a Sunday morning and you have some awesome experience, or you're at a conference for a weekend, and you have what people call mountaintop experience. But then on Monday, you got to come back and go to work, or you got to come back and go into your normal life. But the mountain of the Messiah, the kingdom, is above all the hubbub and idolatry of the world. You're not going to get up the mountain if you're just focused on the idolatry of the world. And Jeremiah chapter 1's talking about this. I mean, you have to read 1 to kind of know what he's talking about here. Because he says, you people have everything. God gave you people everything, but you're not happy. You know, you have the totality of the revelation of God, but you're making idols. I don't get it. What are you people thinking? You know, why are you making idols when you have the Torah, the other prophets, the revelation of God? So he says this mountain is above all that. And it's going to involve everybody from every nation. And he says we're going to learn his ways on the mountain. We're going to see him as he is. He's going to teach us who he is. He's going to teach us We're going to learn about him. Don't you think when we get to heaven, we're going to be learning about God for all eternity? We won't ever figure it out, but we'll always be learning. You know, Paul Wilbur once described it as, there's the passage in Revelation about God being described as all these beautiful stones and the light coming. He says it'll be like there's all these multifaceted, beautiful stones that light bounces off, and every once in a while, the stone turns a little bit, so you get a whole new thing of light. You go, wow, I didn't know that before. And it's going to go on through all eternity where you're going to learn about this. Even when we're in the mountain, on the mountain, in the promised land, we're still going to be learning about him. We're never going to say, oh, we got it figured out now. That's pretty cool, God. We got you figured out now. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. And there's a great passage in 1 Corinthians. I can't remember. It might be chapter 2. I see Monica might be able to look it up over there. Where it's, Paul says, the Holy Spirit plumbs the depths of God. Some translations say he scrutinizes the depths of God. So the Holy Spirit himself, who is God, kind of plumbs through the whole depths of God. Because God is so complex that even the Holy Spirit kind of scrutinizes all that. So we're not going to go there with our little minds and say, oh, now we get it. Just like, you know, how do you understand that the Messiah is the God-man? Oh, yeah, you know, he's like half God, half man. No, he's 100% God, 100% man. But he looks like a regular man. So how do we figure that out? We're never going to be able to figure it out. And we're going to learn his ways because we're taught as we're going up the mountain too, right? Because we're taught by his word and we're taught by the Spirit. You know, how many times do you read a Bible verse and you read it and you go, huh? Then you read it again and all of a sudden you say, oh, now I get this. Because you're taught by the word and by the Spirit. So if you are getting into the stream going up the mountain, you're going to learn his ways. You're going to learn his word. You're going to learn about him as you go. Because he reveals himself. Then that fifth verse is, house of Jacob, come, let's walk in the light. And boy, you know, isn't that applicable now? Because here's the biological children of Jacob, who are Israel in the flesh, missed the Messiah. So Isaiah didn't know that was going to happen, of course. Even the later prophets didn't really know that was going to happen. But here Isaiah writes, house of Jacob, let's walk in the light. You know, the Messiah came. He's meant for you. He's one of you. He's the promised one that comes from among you. Come on, let's get with it. Let's walk in the light. You know, Paul, remember Paul in Romans says, you know, the Gentiles have been brought to faith to make Israel jealous. And then Israel will ultimately, eventually be saved. Hope it's tomorrow. They'll be ultimately saved. But the house of Jacob isn't walking in the light. We were talking about that this morning, too. The children of Jacob are still doing, or trying to do, the same things they were doing when Jesus was here in the flesh. They don't have a temple, but everything else they're trying to keep doing instead of walking in the light, which they missed. Because their Messiah also becomes a light to the nations. So like Paul points out, and even Jesus himself points out, that when the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled, then Israel will be saved. We've been in the time of the Gentiles a long time. That's how we all got here, right? We've been in the time of the Gentiles a long time. But the Gentiles go where they couldn't go before. If all of us as a bunch of Gentiles would have gone up those steps going to the temple, we could have been singing the psalms and stuff. But when we got to the top, somebody would have said, excuse me, you can't come in here. Right? I mean, if you had a bunch of unclean Gentiles strolling around inside the temple, we'd have desecrated the whole place because we were unclean. But now the Gentiles get to go where they couldn't go before. And remember, and also in Isaiah, we did the thing about the vineyard, a couple months ago. You know, and then later Jesus himself says, the kingdom is going to be taken away from you, meaning the Jews, and given to people that are going to produce fruit. You guys don't want to produce fruit? Okay. Then we're going to get somebody else to produce the fruit. You guys aren't going to glorify the Messiah? Well, we're going to find some other people who are going to glorify the Messiah. And you guys can just sit there being stupid instead of walking in the light. Remember in Romans chapter 2, Paul says, of all the people, they should have been the ones that got this. They had all the things. So 700 years before the crucifixion, Isaiah says, house of Jacob, you got to walk in the light. Of course, he's talking about, too, at that time they're worshiping idols. So they had light, and now they're doing darkness. Then they have the true light, but they're still doing darkness without the idols. Is that cool or what? So this whole thing is the Messianic kingdom. We're going to do the second half of the chapter next week because there's cool stuff there too. But you can see that it's the one new man and it's something above everything else that's been or ever will be. And prophesied 700 and some years before Jesus was even born.